Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And I'm going on leave after today's show, just to let you all know. I will be posting an interview I did with former FBI General Counsel Jim Baker, talking about the crypto wars. That should be up tomorrow, I think. And then while I'm away, I'll probably post a soapbox, likely week after next. But there's no weekly news show for a couple of weeks. Being constantly plugged into what's happening in InfoSec can be a little bit draining, not surprisingly. So holidays, I think, are important. You should take one too. Listeners, take a holiday. This week's show is brought to you by Remediant. Remediant CEO Tim Keeler will be along in this week's sponsor interview to have a chinwag. We'll be talking about how simple security tech is really in vogue these days and how that's a good thing. That one's coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, this CBP breach, Customs and Border Protection in the US, they've lost a whole bunch of data, including those photos they take of travelers as they enter the US.
Yeah, this is really, really not a good thing for them. What appears to have happened is that they had a subcontractor that was involved with maintaining, I think, some of the vehicle, like license plate reading camera systems, who had apparently caused some of the data to be copied across to their own corporate network. Then they subsequently got themselves breached, and a bunch of data is now out of the Customs and Border Protection's patrol. And it's just really bad, I guess, bad timing for them, because obviously they're the subject of quite a lot of angst in the US because of the kind of border policies in general, plus the level of oversight that they are facing for having to collect a whole bunch of really sensitive data for a bunch of people who have no alternative, right? You can't not, if you're going to cross the US border, you can't not interact with them. And it's just, the can is proverbially open and worms are everywhere.
Now, you did just mention the license plate stuff, and that's been out there for a couple of weeks. It was initially reported on by the Register, and then Team Motherboard also wrote it up. But what's new this week is, I think it was Washington Post broke the story that this also included the mugshots that you are forced to endure when you enter the United States.
Yeah, they are saying the contractor wasn't supposed to have that data, but I mean, in the end, it's their responsibility to make sure that that's technically the case, as well as just kind of contractually. Although I'm sure the company in question is going to have a pretty rough time of their business relationship with the CBP.
Now, we've got a great supply chain story this week, which is a manufacturer of Android devices had their supply chain thoroughly owned, and these attackers were able to get malware on the devices, at time of manufacture. And because, this malware was hooked in pretty deep, you just couldn't really remove it, which is kind of a problem.
Yeah, this is also not a good look for Google's ecosystem. The story appears to go that this was a number of vendors that were having their images processed by third parties to kind of add extra features or something like that. I was a little bit vague on exactly, what value was being added by these third parties that the OEMs were sending their images off to have extra work done on them. Anyway, they were infected with something that was then modifying the Android images. I mean, it seems to be kind of dropping adware and other really low-value crap, which I'm kind of surprised about given the sophistication of the of the supply chain side of it, but it just goes to show, right?
Well, but I mean, this is a by its nature, it's a scale attack, right? You're not going to do something really, really nifty and niche and targeted and badass when you're owning everything coming out of the factory. You've got to find a way to monetize at scale. And
I guess you're right. We're always looking for the sneaky high sophistication angle. Common Garden stealing people's money or showing them ads or whatever is not it's not that fun.
No, it's not. But I mean, it is unusual, isn't it, to see really sophisticated attacker behavior that results in something really dumb as their way to make money.
Well, yeah, right. And I guess that just, it does show that this level of sophistication is applicable to dumb outcomes as well, because, anyone can do it, I suppose.
Yeah, the manufacturers, I can't say I'd ever heard of, but it's Ligu and Nomu. Yeah, I know, right? So, I mean, if it was Samsung, this would be bigger news. But who knows what their supply chain looks like? Am I right?
Well, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, as someone buying a piece of software, buying a phone, how are you supposed to know who's involved in supply chain to make a good risk decision about it? Not that people who are buying low cost Android phones probably are thinking about security risk management, but
I think this is just sort of more illustrative, isn't it, of the bigger concerns around supply chain stuff. It's a great example. It's, you know, for those people who talk about this stuff, you know, this is one for the slide decks.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, now staying with mobile, and we've got a bit of research from a firm. Again, look, I haven't actually heard of this company, but the company is called Wandera, and they scanned 30,000 iOS applications in the App Store and found that two-thirds of them-ish disable a feature called ATS, which is a iOS feature that restricts app communication to TLS. So they're like, no, we can't have that because apparently it might interfere with fallbacks for ad serving. So it'll cost people money. So they just disable it. It's a little bit depressing when you see a development kit actually introduce a very useful feature like this and people just disable it.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, you can understand, right? I mean, doing things like cert pinning is great for production releases, but, you know, when you're doing development, it's really hard and gets in your way a lot. And I'm sure a lot of developers turn it off once and then forget, right? It gets set in the build parameter somewhere and then no one thinks about it ever again, and it ships to production as is. Certainly, the interaction with ad networks is interesting because we have seen, you know, a bunch of research and sort of opinion pieces talking about, you know, the relationship between, you know, lower cost or, you know, freemium stuff, things that the advertising supported, generally having a lower level of security there, therefore kind of like penalizing people who are less well-heeled through having less secure
products.
Well,
that's the argument, right? Of iPhone versus Android right there, you know, which is...
Well, yeah, exactly. It was between the two platforms as well. But I mean, here within the Apple ecosystem that there is, you know, they produced some statistics showing the difference between free apps and, you know, and paid apps for this particular feature being disabled. And it was higher in those that were ad supported because of the necessity to make it work with all sorts of weird ad networks.
It's pretty funny how people will go out and, you know, spend $4 on a coffee or, you know, drink $5-6 beers all day. But the idea of paying $2.50 for an app is like, no way, you know, like
it is a little strange. Yes, I certainly would much rather pay and not have ads shoved in my face the whole time. But I mean, then again, that's a privilege, right?
Yeah, I remember like when I started paying for apps, like it was actually quite liberating. I'm like, yeah, wow, you know, these things are actually quite good.
It's almost like, you know, paying for media or paying for software. Like, I mean, growing up as a teenager, you know, pirating stuff. It's actually really nice and easy to just pay for it. Like as an adult, this is way better.
Yeah, not having to like roll the dice on just how owned you're going to be after you run that crack.
Exactly. Yeah. All those wonderful crack throws owning up your stuff.
Man. Yeah. Now we've got a write up here from Wired about the failure that we discussed last week, the Google Cloud outage, and it is much the sort of thing that you would expect. It's just a really nice example of a cascading failure. Like it was a config change that just went wrong.
Yeah, as I understand it from the Google write-up, it sounds like the network management stuff got kind of descheduled off a piece of hardware that was being worked on or a cluster that was being put into a maintenance mode, and then the network kind of cascaded out into a failure from there. They have actually done a reasonable, you know, more detailed write-up than I thought we were going to see. Obviously, Google understands that people do need to have some degree of transparency into their failures to have some trust that it was an actual complicated problem, not just, you know, someone tripped over a cable and that ruined everything. So yeah, it is a good write-up if you're into that kind of thing.
You do wonder how long it is going to be before we see one of these that is so bad that it actually takes, you know, a few days to restart, because it's got to be coming one day.
Well, it has to happen eventually, right? One day something really, really bad will happen, and then we'll get to see the true level of interconnectedness of everything on the internet. Because I mean, seeing all of the Google stuff fall over because Google Cloud components were down was certainly kind of interesting. And we could imagine the same thing with, you know, with Amazon or Azure.
Yeah, look, I had an interview, and look, much like all of the other interviews I've ever done with Dan Gear, they become very topical and relevant years after you've done them. But I spoke to him years and years ago about how multi-cloud won't save you, because if you've got, say, everybody on Google has like a standby, you know, multi-cloud backup at like Amazon, what will happen is if there is a, you know, all of Google outage, everybody's going to try to hook over at the same time, and there's just not enough scale there to absorb all that extra compute, right? Multi-cloud doesn't save us from this problem, I think is what I'm getting at here.
Yeah, I think it saves salesmen from lack of a new Jaguar.
Yes, Jaguar. There you go. That's an interesting choice, Adam, but sure, Jaguar.
What is? Pick a thing. I don't know.
It's got what salespeople crave. The Walrus. John Bolton, who is Trump's national security advisor, he's been making some comments about how, you know, it's more of this defend forward stuff that we're seeing come out of the US in terms of like their approach to all things cyber. He's saying the US is going to be going after crews who are taking intellectual property from American companies much more aggressively. I don't know what that's going to look like. I don't know if that's just going to mean more samples submitted to, to VirusTotal, right? Because that seems to be something Cyber Command's been doing. You know, I don't know exactly what this looks like, but certainly the message is clear, which is they're happy to be moving into the direction where it's turning into like a what we call on the show a cyber knife fight.
Yeah, we have seen them in the examples in the past where they've like disabled internet access, for example, in some of the Russian organizations that are interfering with elections, you know, kind of pushing that sort of thing into other areas is one way. Another, as you described, of course, is, you know, ruining people's tools and techniques on VirusTotal or, you know, maybe dropping them on Telegram groups, cough Iran, to try and, you know, disrupt the operations. And, you know, the Americans are pretty good at the cybers, so they probably got a bunch of good ideas on how to do this in a way that, you know, keeps everybody guessing as to what they're doing. I mean, they don't want to come out and say, we're going to do specifically this, this, and this. You know, they want you to think, the Americans are all up in my business. I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go hack a dam in Idaho today. Do they have dams in Idaho? I don't know.
I don't know either. But it'll be fun when we start seeing the results of this, right? You can't argue with that.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one to see. And especially when we start to get some real kind of concrete attribution that this was an American, you know, kind of counter-op in progress. Because, I mean, right now we're all just kind of in the fuzzy, who knows what's going on phase of the cybers that, you know, I guess we've been in the whole time.
Yeah, now look, staying with the US government and the US President Donald Trump and the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, they can't seem to get their stories straight on what exactly the government's attitude towards Huawei is. Because you've got the Treasury Secretary saying this is a gravely serious national security issue, and you got Trump saying, well, I don't know, if we come up with a good trade deal, maybe we can work something out. And that, you know, these comments are occurring like within hours of each other.
Yeah, it's kind of not a great look, right? They kind of need to decide exactly what's going on here. Like, is this trade and international relations? Is this national security? Like, is Huawei really this kind of grave risk that we all have to be worried about? Or is this really just part of a bigger negotiation? And we're going to see all of this anti-Huawei, you know, kind of rhetoric just backed out with no warning when someone decides something about tariffs, you know, and that is just not a great position, especially for, you know, those allies and people, you know, Australia and New Zealand, for example, who are expected to kind of follow the Five Eyes party line, but to do so on national security reasons rather than because of American trade balance, you know.
Look, I'm with you on that. And I think this does matter. Like, it's easy to write it off and just go, oh, this isn't important. But, you know, when you've got such contradictory signaling coming out of, you know, ostensibly the most powerful government in the world, you know, it just makes it really hard to take the US government seriously on issues like this in the future.
That's it, right? It's the crying wolf scenario. We're willing to take their word that there's a whole bunch of classified stuff that Huawei's done that's bad, or ZTE or any of the other people that we've seen, you know, in the last 6 months to a year. You know, we're taking their word on it out here in the unclassed world. And
well, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I mean, we have seen a lot of stuff hit courts, right? Like in the case of ZTE, you know, it was really about selling stuff to Iran, and, you know, there's a paper trail on that stuff. And, you know, we've seen a bunch of lawsuits pop up showing Huawei stealing a whole bunch of IP. I think they've put enough on the table that it seems pretty clear that Huawei has been involved in, let's just call them shenanigans.
Yeah, and we have seen, you know, some examples with the CFO who was arrested, them talking once again specifically about kind of sanction-related stuff. But, I mean, that is kind of separate to the, you know, much larger national security concerns. So anyway, it would be unfortunate to see the outcome of this be that a year from now, right, they're saying the same things about some other vendor and we're left going, you're just a bunch of d-s.
Yeah. No, I agree. And staying with Huawei, an executive had a very interesting experience appearing before a hearing in the UK, a government hearing.
Yeah, apparently this was a kind of a hearing talking once again about the sort of issues with Huawei, and the guy was kind of challenged about how he felt working for a company, you know, that, you know, operates at the behest of the Chinese government and supports all of the bad things that China does, you know, kind of inside and near its borders, and eventually got accused of being a quote, moral vacuum.
Yes, so that was Huawei's global cybersecurity and privacy officer, John Suffolk. I'm kind of glad this conversation's coming up, right? Because we spoke about this, you know, Alex Stamos and I spoke just in the wake of the Christchurch shooting about the role that Cloudflare plays in supporting the distribution of white nationalist propaganda around the internet, and their line has always been, well, you know, we're just an infrastructure provider, and this guy's line working for Huawei seems to be, well, you know, we just sell equipment. What's it to you? And I think it's good that we're actually starting to see policymakers cotton on to this idea that technology providers are actually enabling various, enabling bad governments, enabling hateful ideologies, and they're sort of being shamed for that a little bit. And I think that's, at the end of the day, I think that's probably going to be a positive thing. And others won't agree, but I do think we need to actually shine a bit of a light onto technology firms and say, hey, what are you doing selling to these people? What are you doing supporting those people? I think that's reasonable. I think we need to have that.
Yeah, I think it underscores the fact that technology has just become a really core part of modern society and modern international relations. And we're seeing this play out in a number of fields, right, in international relations, like with China and Huawei versus the US on trade. And we're seeing it play out with things like Cloudflare and supporting white nationalism. We expect these, organizations, these companies to kind of play a role in civil discussion that's proportionate to what they play in making everything work, right? It's no longer a bunch of nerds. It's no longer, Facebook's not a college campus, dating system anymore, right? I mean, it's a global multinational communications network that's integral to people's lives. And the same is true with, we've seen all of this conversation about WeChat and censorship in China recently with the, Tiananmen Square anniversary going past, these things are just really, really important, and much, it's kind of gets snuck up on a bunch of us nerds, I guess, is where I'm heading.
Yeah. Look, I saw some really interesting stuff going around about the, the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, and I think if you were caught posting anything about Tiananmen Square, you got your account locked, and in order to get it unlocked, you needed to submit stuff like photos of yourself and voice samples, right? Like, the whole Chinese surveillance machine is going in, surveillance and censorship machine, it's gone into bloody hyperdrive lately.
Yeah, and it's really terrifying because it does kind of show what the path forward looks like. I mean, we think, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol are bad. Like, I mean, what the Chinese government is capable of doing and is doing at a mechanized scale is just terrifying. And we look to the situation in China as, what can happen to the rest of us out here in the West, if we don't kind of heed some of those warnings and figure out a more sensible balance.
Yeah. Now, look, staying with the cheery news, and apparently Russia and Iran, well, this is the headline here from Wired. Russia and Iran plan to fundamentally isolate the internet. Does the story match the headline?
I don't know that it does. But it is very much on the arc of things that we're talking about here. And this is a report talking about the progress that Iran and Russia have made in kind of making a domestic internet that they can plausibly sever from the core internet if they need to, or apply some kind of controls in the same way that, say, the Chinese do on their internet perimeter. And I mean, Russia's been doing a bunch of work on DNS, like having their own core DNS infrastructure available, having their own routing infrastructure, and having mechanisms within the ISPs to be able to, cut or severely restrict international ties, should they need to. And I mean, Iran obviously has similar concerns. They don't want all of the Americans up in all of their IP business all the time anymore. They've been preparing as well. Whether that counts as kind of, fundamentally isolating the internet, I mean, perhaps in a way that we... I mean, in the sense we haven't necessarily seen, say, the DNS partitioned before or the BGP space partitioned before, that is kind of a lower level than, filtering domain names or TLS, SNI exchanges or something that we see, say, in China.
Mm. Now, look, just speaking of BGP and China and all of that, like, we've seen another case of a whole bunch of traffic being routed from the West, in this case Europe, through China Telecom. The thing that's becoming increasingly difficult to ascertain is whether or not this is some sort of shady, like, Chinese government snooping activity, or if it just keeps happening because China Telecom is a trash fire, basically.
it is hard to tell the difference sometimes.
But yeah, walk us through exactly the mechanics of this, and then that statement might make a bit more sense to the listeners.
So, yeah, in this case, a Swiss data center provider that's otherwise kind of reputable, called Safehost, funnily enough, They leaked a whole bunch of routes that were kind of, you know, incorrectly configured. It appears innocently to one of their upstreams, which was China Telecom. China Telecom then re-advertised those into the global BGP pool. And of course, that got accepted because they're a, you know, kind of tier one provider and there wasn't filtering on their announcements. And a whole bunch of traffic ended up getting hoovered off through China Telecom's European points of presence. Not actually backhauled through China, I don't think, for the trace routes that I saw. But yeah, so in this case, the suggestion, I think, is that it's not necessarily malicious in that their routes originated outside of China Telecom but got propagated through it and, you know, inherited their trust by the other big providers, but that China Telecom was incompetent in, you know, allowing those routes to propagate.
But they would not be the only ones, right, like where this would happen.
No, no, I mean, there's certainly plenty of incompetent tier one ISPs out there. That's, yeah, and other tiers, of course, I say as an ex-ISP employee. But, I mean, people have learned this lesson the hard way over the years, and there's a bunch of controls that, you know, network operators have in place to try and make sure their announcements are sane. But then there's also having the process that, you know, when one of your engineers inevitably screws it up and you do advertise, you know, the wrong thing, that you can fix that in reasonable time. And in this case, they didn't, right? It took, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours in some cases for the routes to be withdrawn and for things to come back to normal. And that's just not good enough.
No, no, it's not. Now, look, just a bit of a follow-up on Baltimore. They're saying their bill for the ransomware is $18 million and counting. I suspect the true cost will be a lot higher once you factor in the disruption to government services, though.
Yeah, and also this these numbers that we're seeing appear to be kind of based on some of the public contracting data that they've got. But there's a whole bunch of emergency contracts that they let, you know, for things like forensics, which we know are very expensive, that we don't necessarily, or we haven't seen publicly kind of accounted for yet. So yeah, the true cost will be much higher, of course. There's people complaining, you know, well, they should have just paid the ransom. We did at least see some sensible commentary in this Ars story, you know, saying that, well, you know, even if you pay it, there's no guarantee they're going to leave your network.
Yeah, I mean, and you still have to do incident response.
You still
at that
have
point,
to do
right?
all of the eviction and incident response parts. So you have to pay that money anyway. So it kind of isn't really a fair comparison. But yeah, I'm sure some of the citizens of Baltimore are not particularly happy with the circumstance that they still find themselves in.
Now, it was either Wall Street Journal or WashPo that did a story too over the last week. I couldn't actually find it. It just sort of disappeared into the maelstrom of this week's news. But it said that, oh, there was Eternal Blue on the Baltimore network because there were two crews of attackers. That's wrong as well. Eternal Blue played no role. I mean, was there one box with one sample from an old infection where there was maybe some module that used Eternal Blue? Okay, maybe. Had nothing to do with the ransomware. I'm doubling down on that statement for your benefit. Enjoy. Now, look, we've all been worried about this RDP, this patched RDP bug, you know, that we are seeing credible people showing videos of them, you know, exploiting it, right? So we are sort of bracing for the possibility of a worm there. But there's a botnet already going out there and just trying to brute force a lot of these RDP connections. I mean, to be honest, I'm surprised to see this as a headline because I would have figured that RDP brute forcing would be just general internet background noise anyway.
Yeah, I think this is only a headline because everyone's looking out for the blue keep worm to show up. And of course, that makes it kind of more newsworthy. But yeah, we've seen a whole bunch of RDP brute forcing. I mean, the idea that you could stick a RDP, you know, single factor Windows RDP on the internet and not have it brute forced and owned horribly in, you know, tens of minutes hasn't been true for a decade. So yeah, it's certainly not new. Although this particular botnet is doing it at scale, I suppose. But, you know, just one FA RDP on the internet, terrible idea, going to get you owned.
It's true. It is true. Listen to the man with the beard. Microsoft is sending out a warning about a spam campaign that, you know, you're going to get an RTF file that if you open it in Word is going to get you good and owned. The thing is, though, there's been a patch available for this bug since 2017, but obviously Microsoft must be seeing it succeed enough that they're putting out a warning. I mean, between this and, you know, the idea that there are just so many organizations out there that are not patching in a timely way. Now, is this a problem that, you know, where enterprises have let this slip more than usual, or is it just becoming a more visible problem? Because I have no real way to tell. I just wondered if you had a feeling on that.
So obviously we see the inside of a lot of people's networks, and you know, a lot of people do keep things kind of mostly patched, but kind of mostly is still, I mean, if we're talking, you know, 2% of boxes on the internet aren't regularly patched, that's still a whole crap ton of people getting a whole crap ton of owned. And as I think as last week we talked about, like, you only have to get one box on your network owned, and if it's the one that's kind of old and rubbish, it's probably going to have more impact than
but
one
in this
of
case,
the
we're talking
boxes.
About client sides in Office, you know, like, who's not patching
we are talking
that
about
stuff?
Well, Office is a hard one, I guess, because there's plenty of people who don't want to move to the new Office because Microsoft's pushing the kind of, you know, services and cloud. And, you know, some people do just want standalone old-fashioned Office.
But you, you can still patch standalone old-fashioned Office.
You can, but then the sort of organization that wants standalone old-fashioned Office also probably isn't super up on patching and, you know, wah, wah. But yeah,
so you're putting this in the inherently legacy basket.
Well, there's just a lot of Office, right? And it's never going to be 100% patched. And, you know, clearly, you know, I mean, I suspect that the rate, I'd be interested to see from Microsoft what the rate of patching for core Windows is versus Office. And I bet you Office is, you know, 10, 15, 20% less patched than probably more, actually. Probably, it is probably, someone from Microsoft, please write in and tell us. I bet you it's way more than that. But yeah, Office is just, you know, is hard for people, harder to change than operating systems. And I mean, this particular bug that they are advising about here is, you know, one of the best Office bugs in ages. This is the one in the equation editor had ported forward from like Windows 95 or something, and they'd lost the source code too, so it never got updated and never got recompiled with modern, you know, memory protection and compiler settings to try and make it more resilient to memcorruption. And yeah, this is this, you know, kind of Office ever bug that they are advising with. So yeah, it's a great bug, so at least, you know, they're advising about a good one.
Yeah. Now look, staying with Microsoft, and there's been a typical sort of disclosure storm in a teacup break over the last 24 hours because Google Project Zero has gone full disclosure on some DOS bug affecting Windows. So that's I see Tavis Ormandy getting pretty vocal about that, and we've saw a couple other people step in and say, hey, you should have given Microsoft more time, and Project Zero is saying, well, it's been 90 days. And I think, you know, what appears to have happened here is Microsoft had a patch ready, and then at the last minute they spotted some problems in regression testing, so they pulled it. And in response, Google has published details of that bug. Now, my personal theory, I haven't actually spoken to anyone at Microsoft, but my personal theory here is they've been a little bit busy patching a whole multitude of local privesks that Sandbox Escaper has been publishing. There's another one this week, I believe, as well. So there's just been all of these like pretty high impact local privesks that they've had to deal with. And maybe this one just got bumped down the priority queue a bit, and that's how they came close, but they missed it in the end.
Yeah, this bug is actually kind of interesting. It's a bug in Microsoft S Channel, the cryptography provider that's at the core of anything that does TLS crypto on Windows. So it's, you know, it's only a denial of service bug, but it's a denial of service in the thing that's kind of forward facing on nearly every modern internet service. So IIS or their IPsec termination or, you know, anything that's handling certificates, and you can trigger this bug. You know, via passing a bad certificate to something that then has to go do certificate checking. Of course, we've spent so long trying to make all of our, you know, crypto stacks do cert checking. You can do this through SMIME email. So it is just a denial of service, and it's an easy
denial of service affecting a lot of important stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's just super effective and, you know, reachable in a lot of ways that other bugs aren't. So I mean, I would be I would hope that they hadn't misprioritized it. My theory is that, you know, you make a change to this thing, it's just used by every single application. Yeah. The fact that you're going to find something that didn't work quite right after this patch doesn't seem super unlikely. And it's really, you know, I guess I find it hard to find fault with either side here. I mean, you know, Microsoft has a really complicated set of things. They got a patch, you know, they've got great testing to spot this stuff. They did, you know, it sucks. They just have to deal with that. And, you know, Project Zero's disclosure timeline, you know, part of its value is that they are unwavering in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole point of the disclosure timeline is to put pressure on companies like Microsoft to be able to do this in 90 days. And that doesn't work.
Ideally, they would be able to. Yeah,
and that doesn't work if you start extending deadlines, right? So, look, I'm sympathetic to both sides here, but I feel like the way forward on this one would be for Microsoft to make an out-of-band patch available to people should they need it, right? So if you start actually getting DOSed off the internet with this bug, it would be nice if there is a patch ready to go. I mean, that just feels like what should happen here.
Yeah, and certainly if we do see this weaponized and used in anger against IIS web servers in bulk, then Microsoft will absolutely patch it out of band.
Yeah, yeah. It would be nice if they didn't. People didn't have to wait for that to happen, though, so that one's ready to go. So just, you know, just a bit of an idea there. Now, this one's interesting, right? We've got Senator Ron Wyden asking the Department of Justice to better account or to account for its use of, you know, exploits like law enforcement, you know, exploits slash Trojan slash whatever you think. I mean, the thinking here seems to be, like what this seems to be, is the senator asking DOJ about this because they're wondering what sort of protections they're putting on this stuff to avoid being, you know, like second tier shadow brokers, right? Because I'm guessing that, you know, NSA has better exploits than the FBI, right? But it still might be an idea to keep an eye on the stuff that they do use. Now, this seems like a reasonable thing to ask of the Department of Justice in the US.
It does seem pretty reasonable to me. I mean, the comparisons to, you know, chemical weapons and stuff may be a little bit overwrought, but yeah, they, you know, they've got a bunch of tooling that people know that they've got, and that's one thing, right? I mean, the NSA, you don't know what they've got. I mean, we assume they've got some sweet toys, but we don't know, whereas we have seen
some
evidence
we
now.
Sometimes when they get worked.
And they get taken home.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, whereas with the FBI, we have a bit more visibility through the court process, et cetera, of what capability they've got. And so it becomes a bit more of a concrete target that you could go after. And so, yeah, it's not unreasonable to ask, you know, what protective measures do you take? Why do they work? How are you going to know when it gets nicked? What are you going to do? Seems like a senator's job.
And I'm guessing that process in the FBI is probably not as tight as it would be for NSA, particularly post-shadow brokers.
Yes, you would expect that would be the case. They'd have a lower degree of sophistication in protecting themselves, and yeah, you know, clearly they have toys that are, you know, still just as interesting.
So look, I'm looking at this as a silver lining to the bad coverage on the Baltimore thing, right? When you've got senators asking reasonable questions of the Department of Justice, hey, not the worst thing. This next piece, I don't really want to talk about it that much. I just really wanted to include it in this week's news summary in the links. It's by Nick Miller, who was my editor for a time at Fairfax Media. He's now the Europe correspondent for Fairfax. And he's just done this fantastic write-up on where things stand for Julian Assange and, you know, all things extradition and espionage charges and whatever. It's just one of the best write-ups I've seen on this.
Yeah, it's a really good piece that pulls together a bunch of the historical context for handling, you know, espionage and freedom of the press stuff in the US that, you know, especially for readers outside of the US is just kind of good background reading. But also I'm kind of sick of talking about Assange as well. So I'm glad that you don't want to talk about it.
Okay. Moving on, the TalkTalk hacker, Daniel Kelly, who was a juvenile offender when he attacked TalkTalk in the UK, has been sentenced to 4 years in prison, 4 years detention in a youth detention facility, which is, you know, it's a pretty stiff penalty. He was naughty, though.
Yeah, he was. It does seem like the story kind of started with him hacking his college and making a bunch of trouble, you know, with people he went to school with. And then that kind of escalated into him hanging out in a bad crowd on the internet and, you know, ransoming people's data and
hanging out with internet toughs.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not ended well for him. It does seem like a relatively sympathetic case in some parts of it. I mean, in that he's, you know, clearly a pretty troubled young man. And, you know, some jail time is I guess inevitable for, you know, given that he was bad. But yeah, it's just, you know, I don't know that anyone wins in this story.
No, it does feel just a little bit harsh, especially considering he's a juvenile offender. But hey, what's done is done. Moving on. And look, this is a really interesting one from Lily Hay Newman at Wired, which is really looking at how a lot of these cybersecurity companies want to be able to give free or discount services to political campaigns. But there are regulations that often prevent that, which is an interesting little snag in trying to bring up the general security posture of political campaigns in America.
Yeah, it's not an aspect of it that I necessarily would have thought about. But of course, there are restrictions on being able to kind of give gifts and support and money to political campaigns, you know, in return for some political gain, because you're meant to be doing this as a, you know, corporations are not meant to be citizens that participate in the political process. And so, yeah, of course, there are some restrictions. And what's interesting is how these laws apply and the extent to which they're still necessarily applicable in a case like this. And we are seeing individual companies kind of apply applying for permission to be able to offer free services or offer services to political campaigns. There's some examples, like, say, Microsoft, who provide a bunch of cloud services, where because they're already providing a bunch of services for free, that they're kind of able to do that because they're doing it for everyone. But yeah, if your individual company is trying to do this, then there may be some wrinkles to it. So yeah, definitely worth reading if you are a company in the US trying to help out in solving some of your electoral problems.
Now, look, staying with the theme of elections, and a voting machine maker, ES&S, who I believe have been in the headlines for all the wrong reasons over the years, their chief executive has written an op-ed in which he's stated that the company will no longer sell paperless voting machines. He's just said, and you know, this is a reversal on their previous stance, and they're just saying, no, we're absolutely not going to sell it. The risks are too great. It's very interesting.
Yeah, clearly somebody has gotten in there and explained to them how Babby is actually formed, because they seem to be reversing their position on, you know, paper trails for electronic voting machines, on, you know, the kind of effectiveness of having, you know, public inspection of the machines. I mean, this is the company that was really critical of the competition at the most recent DEFCON to break into a bunch of voting machines. They were saying that this was, you know, helping voting machine hackers and was not a useful part of the process for them. They seem to have kind of reversed that whole position. So this is good. You do wonder, you know, who exactly got up in their face and told them how it was. Like, we saw Rob Joyce, for example, telling them they were wrong on Twitter a while ago. So yeah, Perhaps that started a snowball of things that ended up, a few home truths for them.
That's it. Now, look, I mentioned it just earlier, but Sandbox Escaper has indeed dropped some more ODE for Win 10 and Server 2019, which is just like, she's making life real hard for Microsoft.
She just keeps on going. And actually, the most recent one that she dropped is really funny. it's a Microsoft Edge writing a temp file, changing file permissions if you start it like a certain way. Like, it's a really obscure, but, you know, perfectly great functional, you know, local, like, utterly legit local privilege. It's just such a funny bug. But yeah, she's clearly got a real knack for finding them. And yeah, maybe Microsoft is having a rough time patching all her bugs.
And there's she's also published bypasses of stuff that they've already patched.
Well, such a menace. It's so great.
Anyway, so yeah, as I say, I have a feeling that might have something to do with why the security response folks at Microsoft are a little bit busy.
It might be the next one.
Yes, this NTLM problem. Geez, walk us through this one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is such a great bug. Some researchers have been doing work on the Windows NTLM, like, challenge response authentication process that happens as part of, you know, Windows authentication in SMB or a bunch of the other Windows protocols that use integrated Windows Auth, which, you know, essentially is the core guts of Windows Auth. And one of the attacks that's plagued this system has been the relay attack, where someone sits in the middle, accepts an incoming authentication request, and then kind of changes where it's going to, relays it onwards, and uses it for their own purposes. So this is really powerful in cases where you don't necessarily have the hash through the hash passing attack. You can pass the challenge response process through and own lots of things. And we've seen a bunch of defenses put in place over the years to make this less potent. So, for example, Microsoft introduced a bunch of signing controls, a bunch of controls to restrict your ability to, you know, take connections from one protocol and pass them to another. So take an incoming HTTP request, cause challenge response to happen, and then use that against SMB or LDAP on another system. So there's a bunch of things to kind of make this difficult. Some researchers have been through the process of essentially kind of downgrading out those protections to be able to then cause relay attacks to work again in a much wider case. And in particular, the SMB case, which is the most powerful one, because it lets you talk to a bunch of the remote procedure calls, all the file sharing, all that kind of thing. Essentially, they just take out the header values that say, hey, I would like to have signing turned on, please, in the right way. And it just works, which, yeah, that's kind of awkward. So Microsoft is going to have to patch this one pretty hard, because it's just, I mean, I guess a lot of people don't have these
settings.
There's
two bugs here. Like, one of them's an RCE, right?
Well, the impact is RCE.
Is that why they're saying RCE?
They're saying remote code exec because you can use it to exec code. If you relay a connection from an admin towards a privileged system, of course, you're going to be able to use that for code exec and onwards. But you can use it for file transfer. You can use it for, you know, modifying the Active Directory through LDAP. You can use it for all sorts of things, which is what we already use relay attacks. I mean, it's a workhorse technique, and this defense of having a message authentication and signing to enforce, to prevent relays, was a really key part of making this attack less viable in a whole bunch of cases, and this just kind of throws it wide open again.
So how fix?
How fix? Apply patches from Microsoft. They've dumped a bunch of patches to address this.
But how have they fixed this? Because this just sounds like, you know, feature exploitation.
So that's a good. I'm not actually sure exactly how they fix it. Where we've seen them do this in the past, it required a bunch of configuration changes as well as the patches.
So you're probably going to be using this in some red teams down the track.
Well, I mean, we used relaying last week on a gig. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's a real workhorse technique, and normally we're stuck with let's relay to LDAP on the domain controller or, you know, some other non-SMB service because signing's turned on for SMB. This just it's party time for us. It's so good.
Now, look, staying with, you know, some pretty sweet bugs, there's another one, and we saw one, I think it was last year, I can't even remember, but Exim, the mail transfer agent, has a remote command vuln, and it looks like pretty bad, actually.
Oh, this is such a great bug. I love it. So this is a bug, once again, out of Qualys. So we're the people who did the last big Exim bug. So clearly somebody at Qualys really, really hates Exim and has been wailing on it. This is just such a good bug. You can send an email with a magic kind of crafted local part, so the name of the user on the system the mail is being delivered to or from, and Exim has a bunch of mechanisms for doing like parameter expansion when it's handling mail processing internally, which amongst other things might let you just run an arbitrary command to kind of generate changes to the email address to, you know, kind of do template expansion. You can trigger this bug locally for privilege escalation and result in command exec, but the real magic comes where you can trigger this bug remotely, and the vector for triggering this remotely involves you basically sending an email that then when it gets bounced, this magic parameter gets evaluated. But in order to hit the code path, they have to hold the mail connection that's sending this message open for a week. And kind of keep the TCP session alive so that they can bypass one of the checks that's checking like the amount of time that the mail's been in flight versus when it got queued. And by, you know, holding the socket open, you can make one differ from the other. And so, yeah, you just like basically you send a byte every 5 minutes or whatever just to keep the TCP stream alive long enough that the bug condition triggers, which is just like, I can imagine like the Qualys dudes sitting around the lab working on this one, and when they finally get it working, just laughing their asses off. This is wonderful.
My favorite thing about this is that they accidentally patched it already.
Well, I mean, the Exim code base is really complicated, which is how we end up with crazy bugs like this. But yeah, the fact that the Exim team did kind of accidentally patch this is just funny. We have seen headlines saying like this one in ZDNet says, you know, like 50% of the internet is vulnerable, which I mean is true in the sense that 50% of the internet runs Exim, but this was quite a narrow band of versions. So
yeah.
And I think Debian is the only main Linux distro that ships Exim as the default MTA.
So don't believe the hype that it's going to, you know, crash half the world's email.
It's not going to take out half the world's internet. It's not going to take out half the world's email, but I mean, there are a bunch of people, and I mean, mainline Ubuntu 18.04 LTS is affected. So I mean, that is a although Postfix is the MTA that you would expect most people to use. But, yeah, it does affect some things, but it's not 50%.
Yeah, well, look, we've got just heaps of bugs this week that are actually kind of worth talking about. I mean, we don't normally spend a great deal of time talking about this type of research on the show, but there is some good stuff. And one thing that really caught my eye this week is some research into HSMs. And we're talking about, like, remote compromise and full key extraction out of HSMs, which is not really what you want in a HSM.
It's like a HSM has one job, right? And that is to keep the crypto keys deep within itself and not give them out. This was from a conference talk by some guys from a French hardware wallet maker Ledger, which I'm assuming is a Bitcoin-related thing. Awkward. They were looking at HSM tech, and they came up with essentially a technique for doing firmware compromise, like replacing the firmware on the HSM to then Trojan it and extract the keys, which kind of makes sense. Embedded systems, they got to have to get their software from somewhere. We all know that sorting out your software supply chain such that you can't have your updates modified is hard, and yeah, it applies in this particular case.
But I mean, it would be ironic if a HSM's getting owned by failing to validate new firmware.
Right. I mean, it'd be ironic, but entirely expected. I mean, certainly my experience of HSMs is that there's a lot of hot garbage sold as an HSM, and people just assume that it's good because it has security in its name. And few people are willing to go check. And when you do, they're kind of garbage like everything else.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't named the vendor here, right? And I think that that is a pretty important detail, because if it is some hot garbage whatever, then okay, no big deal. But if it's one of the major ones, then yeah, that's a problem.
Although, you know, if you get near the HSM, you probably already won, so, you know.
Yeah, but you can win more.
You can win more.
Now, look, we're also seeing some more interesting applications of the Rowhammer technique. There's a new paper out. This one looks pretty cool.
Yeah, this was kind of an update to Rowhammer to use it to kind of read memory. Like we've seen Rowhammer used to change values in memory. This particular one is sort of a novel, but I guess obvious now that it's explained to you, application of Rowhammer, where you take one particular row of memory, you put some values in it, the next row in memory contains the thing you want to read out, and then you hammer it such that the row after, which you're subsequently reading, gets hammered by the contents of the row that you don't know about in combination with the one that you do know before it, and you end up being able to read memory out, which, yeah, actually seems kind of smart now that I read about it. I didn't think of that. Yeah, good work.
Yeah, and it's just another example of how these things that start off being highly theoretical just, you know, have a habit of becoming more and more viable. So I don't think it's going to be an attacker's tool of choice just yet, but watch this space. We've got a typical sort of data exposure incident at a large IT company called Tech Data. The only reason I wanted to include this one for discussion is it's really a case study on how this sort of stuff happens. You know, it's a case study in what not to do. And in this case, it's like stuff winding up in logs that shouldn't be winding up in logs, and then those logs being freely available on the internet.
Yeah, which when you're a, what is it, like $40 billion tech company, you're going to have a bad time if you don't keep that stuff under control. But obviously, you know, this is the consequence of having so many things easily available on the internet to build out of cloud parts, is that stuff just ends up lying around in the cloud. And yeah, you put all your logs in one place, someone's going to read them.
Yeah. Last week we spoke
about... Your ops team may not, but I mean, someone might.
Last week we spoke about this case of the phishing lure that looked really effective against O365 admins. And one of the things that we noted, or that was noted in the story that we discussed, was that you had this situation where the link in the lure, you know, would show up as a valid Microsoft property because it was, you know, it was Microsoft cloud hosted. The FBI has actually, you know, issued some warnings about this, and also about, you know, free DV certs being used on phishing pages. And they're basically saying, forget about all of that advice of looking for a padlock, right? I just found that interesting that, you know, the FBI's got to the point where they feel they need to issue guidance saying, you know, SSL doesn't really mean anything anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the world we live in now. Like, you can no longer trust that padlock, and the FBI says so, which...
And you could only ever trust it a little bit, right? And now I guess what the FBI is saying is you can't trust it at all. Yeah. Next up, Diebold has warned its customers of an RCE bug in its older ATMs. But, you know, I sort of get the feeling that their systems aren't really that good anyway. So, I don't know. We're just seeing an issue on one of the older ones.
Yeah, Diebold are a pretty special firm. I mean, they have swallowed up, you know, a fairly significant portion of the kind of ATM and other, you know, cash handling voting systems kind of space. They're a really big player in that market. And yeah, they own a bunch of different software stacks for handling ATMs. This particular one, somebody went full disclosure on them. I think it was like a Vietnamese crew had got hold of an ATM somehow and went looking through one of the network listing services and turned that into remote code exec and then attempted to communicate that with Diebold, which as anyone who's tried to deal with them probably will find that's a losing proposition, and they ended up going full disclosure on them. Diebold's now claiming it's a, you know, less used software stack, and you know that they are now talking to the people who found the bug and it's all fine, but... Yeah, they're not a great place to rely on for securing large amounts of your cash stored in ATMs, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I know a red teamer who had an interesting run-in with them, found a whole bunch of stuff, reported it to them, and they came back to my red team friend's client and said that the engineering work to rectify this horrible vulnerability or series of vulnerabilities in their products would, you know, they'd bill them for that work.
Oh, dear. So this is why we invented full disclosure, is for vendors.
Yeah.
Vendors like Oracle and vendors like Diebold.
So look, you know, bugs in some of their old stuff, tip of the iceberg. Yeah. Anyway, we were just speaking, I think, last week, the week before, sometime around then, about how, we're just seeing more and more problems sort of become apparent in, Bluetooth devices. Microsoft is now blocking a bunch of Bluetooth devices in their patches. But I think they're, it's less about the exotic stuff and more just blocking certain devices that use common keys, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, this is good because, protecting users from things they don't necessarily know about. I mean, most people aren't going to be following, the details of all of the Bluetooth-connected devices that they've got and the security patch status of them. Like, that's not reasonable. So helping consumers deal with that is a good thing. On the other hand, anytime you break a piece of equipment in a patch on purpose, right, you do risk alienating people from patches, and you don't necessarily know what other things. I mean, certainly in the case of the Google Titan fobs, we saw people getting locked out of their accounts because they couldn't necessarily fix the issues that needed to be addressed with those Bluetooth fobs in enough time. So yeah, I mean, there are some consequences to this.
And of course, I think that's the one where I'd defend it, right? Like if they're breaking inconsequential stuff, right? Like, oh no, my cheap Bluetooth headphones don't work anymore. I would agree that that would be kind of a dumb thing to block in a patch. But when you're talking about a device used exclusively by people, more or less exclusively by people in Google's advanced protection program, you kind of want those users to not use this tech, right? Like you really want to break that.
Yeah, I do agree, right? I mean, there is a trade-off conversation to be had, and I'm sure they've done that equities process when they decided to roll this out. I would like to see them block a whole bunch of the real garbage stuff, and that's my criticism here, is there's so much terrible Bluetooth everything that doesn't get the attention that, say, the Google Titan fobs did, that's, probably worse. Bluetooth keyboards, things like that are spewing your creds out onto the airwaves. I'd like to see those probably garbaged before, an obscure, well, maybe it wasn't that obscure bug in an auth fob, but you're right. Those are high impact devices.
Yeah. Andy Greenberg's got a nice write-up on Wired about the new Find My Apple device feature. It's using Bluetooth low energy beaconing and stuff. And, the idea being that, if your phone gets pinched and it can get picked up by, other people's Bluetooth devices and, they've sort of built a mesh network that way for finding devices. That's pretty interesting. We've run out of time to talk about that one. VLC has released 3.0.7 and it's a massive security release because of that EU bug bounty. We spoke about it when they first announced that.
Yeah, this seems like a really good outcome. I mean, it's a really widely used piece of software, and that bounty program has clearly been pretty effective at shaking out a bunch of bugs. So, yeah, good for everybody.
Hooray. Oh, now, I found this write-up. It just crossed my desk. I can't exactly remember how, but it's a write-up on how to create basically a rogue LTE base station. It's kind of like a how-to, and I did not realize that this was possible and easy. I thought that most of the time, if you wanted to, man in the middle a mobile device, you had to do some sort of downgrade attack and force an association onto a 2G connection. But this looks like, rogue LTE base station.
Yeah, it certainly is possible to stand up this stuff, and having a walkthrough that explains a bunch of the gotchas and stuff is really useful. If you're trying to do this yourself from a bunch of the public docs, it is a pretty tedious process, and having someone go through it all for you is absolutely helpful. It will save you a bunch of time. If you've got some of this radio gear lying around, it's certainly worth doing in the lab before you need it. Of course, do be careful when you're working on licensed frequencies. Some jurisdictions take that thing much more seriously than others, and will show up at your house and give you a bad time. So
they'll put you in the van.
They will put you in the van. Yeah. So don't mess with radio frequency spectrum operators. They are quick to anger.
Well, that's it, mate, for the news this week. And I've got 2 weeks leave, which means you get 2 weeks off Risky Biz as well. So I'll speak to you again in 3 weeks from now.
Yes, and maybe after that we will finally see the giant IDP worm ruin the internet. That is
probably
what happens.
I will be sitting on a beach somewhere with a daiquiri in hand.
You better hope the daiquiri ordering system is not done through some point of sale Windows box.
Ooh. That is the sort of cyber 9/11 that I'm terrified of, to be honest. The daiquiri ordering machine. I hope they're not using a smart blender.
Yep, that IoT blender is going to ruin your drink, my friend.
All right, mate. Well, have a great 3 weeks, and I'll speak to you then.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Tim Keeler, the CEO of Remediant. Remediant is a small but growing company that makes what I'd call an alternative to password vaults. That's one way to think of it. Their tech is basically a box. You drop it on your network, and it's primarily used to time lock privileged accounts. They're a just-in-time administration play. And there are a couple of things I really like about Remediant. The first is that it's actually quite easy. And the second is that it gets you quite a long way pretty quickly, right? So it's like as light touch as something like this can be. Anyway, access control is one of the fundamentals in security, and I'm seeing a bunch of startups these days offering tech that delivers simple access control. So think of CMD and their Linux security play. Think of the Australian guys at Airlock Digital who are making whitelisting tech that is actually usable. Duo is post-exit, so not really a startup, but they were an access control play as well and wound up being a $2 billion company. So Remediant falls into this simple access control category for me as well. And basically they just, you know, revoke privilege from every account in your environment where possible. There are, of course, some exceptions. And then to use those accounts, you log into their appliance, enable access for a time period, like an hour, you go use that account. And when the time window expires, that's it. The account loses privileges. So it's easy. I started off by asking Tim if he agrees there's been a shift in attention lately away from exotic detection and response tech and back towards the basics. Not surprisingly, he agrees that that's what's going on. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think everyone is really shifting back to fundamentals. You know, we take a look at the breach reports, and it's so repetitive these days. I think everyone is, you know, really, it's sinking in. It's like, hey, there's fundamentals at play, and we really need to go back to basics in order to get things just like basic visibility and understanding around, you know, like things like ACLs, who has admin permissions, how do you put those basic controls into place is really key.
Yeah, and it is like owning a Windows network sort of is like mowing the lawn both for pen testers and attackers right now. And there are some reasonable things you can do to make that a lot harder. But I guess the thing is like tooling helps, right? When you can sort of automate or speed up the process of doing good access control, you know, maybe that's the sort of tool we need instead of something that's very, very exotic.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, just based on my experience from incident response and, you know, helping enterprises deal with, you know, the breakdown of the breach is, you know, it really boils down to, you know, nobody really understands the state of admin controls and admin permissions. And, you know, and then we see, you know, the attacker's playbook. This is something that is being just exploited consistently and constantly, you know, to the point where, you know, you aren't set up for good security posture if you don't even understand who has basic admin permissions on systems or applications in your environment.
Now, one thing I wanted to bounce off you, sorry, I didn't give you forewarning of this, but it's been very interesting for me being involved a little bit with a startup, right? And seeing, getting a feel for how the VC market works and what's considered a success and what's not. Because it really feels to me like a lot of the best ideas are coming up in these companies where their value is kind of going to cap out between $50 and $150 million, right? When they're fully built, when they're fully developed, they're going to wind up being $50 to $150 million companies, right? Whereas the VCs, they're only interested in funding things that are going to be $500 million plus. So I sort of feel like there's this swing towards small vendors doing simple things that solve substantial problems for a subset of the enterprise. And I kind of feel like that's where it's at. That's where I'm seeing the interesting technology right now, instead of VCs trying to fund a $1 billion fix for everyone's problems, right? Which is what they've been trying to do for so long. What do you think of that idea that perhaps the smaller vendors is where it's at? Well, I suppose, you know, being a smaller vendor, you're probably going to agree with that, right?
yeah, to some degree. And, you know, I've worked in, you know, enterprise IT for long enough, you know, both in managing internal and then working with companies, you know, dealing and actually selling out to the market. And, you know, I think what happens is, you know, over time, especially as a company grows, their process and their ability to innovate becomes a big struggle for them. And they start losing touch from what the actual customer needs are. And this is the huge opportunity for startups to say, hey, we work with these, you know, these types of companies and customers. We know their challenges firsthand. And we've even, you know, through our own industry experience, had our own frustrations with the lack of tools and the lack of technology and automation that plays nice with the rest of, you know, the security stack or the technology stack. And at the end of the day, we just want to add some value. I mean, that was really my passion for coming into this, is to see, you know, the problem happening over and over and over, and enterprises investing large amounts of money to try to solve, you know, problems around privilege access. And at the end of the day, you know, even despite going through a very long and, you know, arduous process implementing technology, they still got owned. And it still was because an admin credential wasn't, you know, just wasn't protected. And when the conversation would go from the customer to the vendor that they purchased this technology from, they would get an answer of, oh, well, you didn't deploy this the right way. Or, hey, you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And when you shift that problem back onto the customer, there's a huge amount of burden. And there's only a finite number of resources. And this
there is a lot of you didn't tighten the wheel nuts when you were supposed to, sir, isn't there in the security business? That's why the wheels fell off, sir. You didn't tighten them.
That's the biggest problem, though, right? Is like, you know, to implement technology is, it's very simple when you compare it to changing someone's behavior or business process. And, you know, we really, you know, we had a real keen eye on this. It's like, hey, these two should be completely integrated and it should just be completely intuitive in order to manage. And so this is where, you know, things like, all right, continuous monitoring and, you know, just being transparent and have visibility around the state of the problem ultimately helps, you know, guide the hand for the customer to say, oh, this is what I should be doing. And by the way, now I have a nice technology solution to help you with that problem.
Yeah. I mean, so there's that term, right, that pops up a lot in the sort of security business side of things, which is heavy lift, right? And look, yeah, that's why I think you're kicking some goals here. So yeah, just to put things into context for the listeners here, you know, Remediant is a bootstrapped company. I think you started sponsoring this podcast about 2 or 3 years ago. You had 5 staff. Now you've got 25, 30 staff. And a lot of that growth seems to have been propelled by the fact that you get a quick win, right? Like, it is certainly not a heavy lift. Do you think that's why it's going well for you? Because I think, you know, there are going to be a lot of other approaches to these types of problems where if you were building a greenfields network, you might even go a different way. But with Remediant, you can kind of, it is something that is easy to retrofit. It's a light touch project. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I experienced this problem of heavy lift, just, you know, trying to implement other technology solutions. And, you know, those were some of the key principles that we wanted to build as part of our technology. It's one thing to have a very, you know, elegant solution, but it's another thing when you don't have to deploy agents out to every single system within the organization, right? That alone gets you to the 12, 18, 24 month in terms of trying to deploy yet another agent out there. And, you know, another problem that I saw was, you know, having to evaluate every single account and put this into something like a password vault. You know, you just need small armies of people and lots of time in order to do these things successfully. And then it's one thing when you go through a large project initiative of, okay, now you have to manage this on your own and continue doing this. And that's really where the heavy lift comes into play. So when we focus
in the Linux example, you do have an agent. It's called SSHD, right? Like, why are more people not using SSH? And like, you know, this has always been the winning way to approach Linux systems. I mean, you know, some of the best Linux admins I know, I mean, the things that they could just do by scripting and, you know, scripting stuff through SSH, it was remarkable. Why would you need an agent? It's Linux.
Absolutely. You know, so you take a look at the DevOps world, right? Everyone uses Chef, Puppet, Ansible, you know, a lot of these tools that basically do SSH connections at the end of the day to, you know, change or manage the bits that you're trying to do on these systems. It's painful to do in the Windows world. And, you know, that's a lot of our IP where we've, you know, been hyper-focused to deploy without agents, and we can deploy at scale. And so put those things two together, that's where we really add value to our customers.
Now, look, you know, just a moment ago, I said that maybe if you were doing a greenfields network build, you might not use Remediant. You know, do you think that's the case, or do you reckon you've got a solid enough pitch that, you know, if you were starting from scratch, you might want to use it?
So what you have to realize is eventually you need to leverage an Active Directory or a full directory system. And that's really where we come in and add those capabilities. So whether it's a cloud first strategy or you have an existing technology infrastructure, we play nice with Active Directory and that ties everything together.
So I guess what you're saying is Greenfields doesn't stay Greenfields forever.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Tim Keeler, very interesting to talk to you, my friend. Always a good chat. Congratulations on the growth in Remediant. It's always nice to see a smaller bootstrapped company kicking some goals and really filling a niche quite nicely. It's been a big year for you. Where do you think this is going to end? I'm just curious because, you know, I had that comment before about, you know, a lot of these best ideas are sort of in the 50 to are a little bit more niche, but simple and are going to sort of wind up in the 50 to 150 mil range. I mean, what's your honest assessment? It's your business. Do you think that you fall into that category, or are you going to try to be the next Duo?
You know, really what I want is for just-in-time administration to be the default and de facto standard for how we think about privilege access. You know, password vaults, they have their place. And I really think it solves about 10% of the overall problems in privilege access management. So I'm on the path to take us to, you know, where we can make this the default standard for any type of platform, application, or technology stack, because the bottom line is you shouldn't have persistent admin privilege out there all the time. And thinking about it through zero trust, least privilege, just-in-time administration just makes the most sense.
There you go. He's going for gold, ladies and gentlemen. He is going for gold. Tim Keeler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
That was Tim Keeler of Remediant there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Remediant for its continued sponsorship of the Risky Business Podcast. That's it from me today. I'll be back with a pre-recorded interview with Jim Baker, the former General Counsel of the FBI. I think I'll be posting that tomorrow. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.